Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 075317, Emergency Coalition to Defend Educational Travel et al. Appellants versus United States Department of the Treasury et al. Mr. Muse for the appellants, Mr. Letter for the appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Robert Muse. I appear on behalf of the appellants. This case presents the court with an opportunity to address two important points of law that have not previously been addressed by this circuit. First, there is the question of what exactly is protected from governmental intrusion by the doctrine of academic freedom. The doctrine of academic freedom, that is, what composite elements of that freedom are secured from government intrusion? I will address in particular the concept of usurpation of essential functions of the academic community.
Mr. Reeves, before you get to your discussion of the merits, I want to ask you about standing. As I looked at the regulations, both the 99 version and the later version, the part of it which presumably applies to Professor Smith looks very similar. So is your argument that neither one of these regulations would make him ineligible?
I think the second, the regulatory action challenged here and sought to be rescinded by the appellants, the complaint in this action, would directly impact Professor Smith. That was the first articulation of the requirement that a professor be a full-time employee of a university in order to teach a course in Cuba. Now, the government has characterized that as a clarification of a pre-existing rule. I've attempted to explain in my brief that that's unconvincing.
But don't you make the argument in your reply brief that even if it were a clarification, your challenge would go to the original regulation in any event?
That's absolutely the case, Your Honor.
So that you would get standing on that ground?
Yes.
Standing is going to be based on whether or not a third party, that is a university, acts. What so it's a third party standing inquiry in this case. What is it that you have to show that Hopkins indeed intends to continue programs?
Several things, Your Honor. There was a letter on file from the provost of Johns Hopkins in the district court protesting with OFAC the rule change and describing its immensely important programs in Cuba and its desire to continue those programs.
Did it say that it was going to continue?
It said in its protest to OFAC that it would have continued those programs notwithstanding, except for the recent rulemaking it was protesting. There are declarations on file from Professor Smith, who heads the Johns Hopkins Cuba program, that he would, I'm trying to be as accurate as I can with his declaration, but it clearly carries the meaning that he would reinstitute those programs as soon as...
Well, it really matters whether Hopkins intends to reinstitute the programs, and there really isn't, there's no affidavit from Hopkins. There are affidavits from other universities that don't make the case. There's a letter from Hopkins that's curious and equivocal, and the fact that there isn't an affidavit from Hopkins and there are affidavits from other universities is a red flag as far as I'm concerned. Why not?
Well, there
it's
are...
your burden to make the case on standing.
Well, but there are no affidavits from other universities.
All right, then you don't have help there either. So the point is there are no affidavits indicating that the third party, who's critical for redressability, has not indicated an intention to continue these programs.
As I argue in my brief, the university acts through individuals. There are declarations on file in the case from Professor Smith, who heads
the university makes its own determinations. The university departments and central administration decide what programs do and do not exist. Individuals don't decide that. Even tenured individuals don't control that determination.
But there is a declaration on file from Professor Gonzalez that heads the Latin American Studies Department at Johns Hopkins, saying that he would reinstitute the courses if freed from this regulatory prohibition.
Where is that?
It's the declaration of Professor Gonzalez. It's in the joint appendix, forgive me. Beginning at page 121.
All right, go ahead.
The second question of law presented by this appeal is to ask this circuit to provide guidance on the Fifth Amendment protected right to travel internationally when that travel is for the purposes of First Amendment protected activity. In this case,
may I go back to your first argument? Our first point, and see if I can examine some of the underbrush. It is your assertion that the academic freedom portion of the First Amendment, arguendo, assuming it exists, applies to individuals as well as to universities. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, here's what I find difficult to grasp under that. Suppose you're a professor at Johns Hopkins, been there for a while, but you start to get a little unusual. Let's say you're a history professor and you become enamored with a Holocaust denial theory and other theories indicating World War II was really initiated by Britain and France rather than Germany. And you begin to teach in the history courses a very bizarre sense of history. Is it your theory that Johns Hopkins is a private university. Suppose it's a public university, University of Maryland. Is it your theory that the University of Maryland couldn't say, you know what, professor, we don't want you anymore. Your teaching is not credible.
The University of Maryland absolutely has that prerogative under any theory of academic freedom.
Then how can the individual have a First Amendment right? Why, if he or she has a First Amendment right, why wouldn't that be a right vis-a-vis the state through the University of Maryland?
That right is mediated and ultimately controlled by academic institutions.
That's another way of saying that the only right is the right, if there is a right, is in the academic institution, not in the individual. Now, you may have a right to present that argument, the Johns Hopkins' position anyway, I'm not sure yet, but I don't think you cannot be correct that an individual professor has a First Amendment right, because if he had a First Amendment right, he would have it against the university itself.
The exact parameters of that individual right vis-a-vis the university is not at issue in this case. We're concerned with governmental
governmental intrusions. Suppose the state of Colorado passes a statute indicating that creationism can't be taught in the University of Colorado. And there is one professor who teaches creationism, and the university says, yeah, we agree, it's nutty. So we weren't going to take him on before, but the state has banned it. And so he shall no longer be able to teach creationism.
Well, that's a difficult case, and I would have to concede that in questions of public expenditure, that I think the state would have that right to control the curriculum.
Like that is content. That is not content neutral. That's content specific. So I can't imagine how there can be an individual right then for under the First Amendment for academic freedom. So that leaves you with the argument that the academic freedom element of the First Amendment, assuming it exists. You don't have any square holding in the Supreme Court to establish that. You do have a concurring opinion. it would be the university's right, and then that goes back to the question of whether or not, as the plaintiff, you have a right to assert the constitutional right of the university. And that may, you may have, you, it's even conceivable you have Article III standing and you don't have prudential standing. Has that occurred to you too? In other words, courts have concluded that even though you may have an injury in fact, and even arguably you have traceability, you don't have prudential standing because the university should be there asserting it, if it's the university's First Amendment right.
But the case law of this circuit is if there's a direct causal nexus that the third party has been so coerced as to harm the individual.
No, the prudential standing doesn't depend on injury, in fact, causation and traceability, but rather the question of whether or not that individual should be treated by the court as an appropriate plaintiff. It comes up often in APA cases, prudential standing, but occasionally in constitutional cases, too. Anyway, go ahead, counsel. I just wanted you to think about that.
Well, I have to revert for a moment to the issue of individual rights of academic freedom. It's not a secret that the doctrine of academic freedom is underexplicated by the courts. It's been recognized. It's been called such things as of transcendent value, but its scope and outline is far from clear. We do have statements in cases like Sweezy versus New Hampshire that emphasize that it was an individual right at issue of that professor as well as the university to employ a man of communist sympathies or whatever the affidavit sought to uncover in his political propensities. So I don't want to leave you with the ultimate impression that I'm conceding that there is no. I think the cases do say there's an individual right of academic freedom, but I think it's far from well developed. The second argument I want to make is as it relates to the district court's reliance essentially on a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case, Freedom to Travel versus Newcomb, that I think misconstrued Supreme Court precedent as it relates to the Fifth Amendment right to travel abroad. And in this particular case, as was said in Zimmel versus Rusk, if there's a First Amendment dimension to the case, there are heightened Fifth Amendment protections. In the district court's opinion, by extrapolation from various cases, including Walsh versus Brady here in the D.C. Circuit, which was a case of essentially a poster importer who wanted to go to Cuba to pick his stock and so on. It did not, first of all, present a clear First Amendment dimension. It was more a case analogizing from a right of access of reporter case. But the essential element I want to get to is the notion that only that intermediate scrutiny is appropriate in a case of this type. The Supreme Court has not said that. That Reagan versus Wald, the 1984 case that last addressed the issue of restrictions on international travel, spoke in terms of weighty interests of foreign policy to justify restrictions. There was a factual finding by the Supreme Court that there had been extensive affidavit evidence presented that the Soviet Union was acting through Cuba as a proxy, as Cuba supported liberation movements in Central America.
You think that was a factual finding of the Supreme Court?
I think it in Judge
Rinn. I hadn't really thought of Supreme Courts making factual findings, but there was material in the opinion to which you refer, but I doubt very much whether it was a factual finding.
Chief Justice Rehnquist put it in the following terms. He said that these weighty considerations, that the restriction in this case on travel to Cuba was justified by these weighty considerations, and then, as you know, reverted to the affidavit evidence that was before the court in that case, before the lower court. So I would submit that properly analyzed, the Supreme Court jurisprudence on restrictions on international travel says that it can only be restricted In any event, notwithstanding First Amendment, strong First Amendment dimension, that didn't exist in the Wald case.
So it, your view is if we all agreed that the embargo of Cuba was counterproductive and silly and long outmoded, your view is we should conclude that these amendments to the regulation are unconstitutional?
Yes, and put in legal terms that if a court must adopt strict scrutiny and must identify a compelling state interest in the embargo. And if that leads you to...
perfectly confident in our judgment on the foreign policy questions. Is that because of our expertise?
It's not so much a foreign policy, it's a constitutional dimension to this case. And your finding would be whether the courts do it all the time, determine whether there are compelling justifications for governmental intrusions into protected rights.
Not normally in the foreign policy area.
Well, in the case of the circuit in Ramirez-Arellano, the circuit has clearly said that foreign policy considerations do not immunize the government from the court's inquiry into constitutional violations, in that case, the Fifth Amendment taking of land.
Why is Walsh inapposite in your view?
Walsh versus Brady?
Yeah.
It's an attenuated case of, there's a First Amendment dimension, but it arises from the importer of posters claiming that he had a quasi-journalistic right. Well, I would say it's inapposite in two different ways. And back to what Judge Silberman said a moment ago. That case was decided in the Cold War context. I would say that that is inapplicable today. You would have to make an independent judgment. Are there weighty issues of...
Has Congress already purported to make that determination?
In 1994, it made the determination that embargo authority on Cuba should not be exercised with respect to educational programs.
Now, wait a minute. There's nothing in... that was not in legislation, was it?
It was, well, it is in fact in the amendment to the Trading with the Enemy Act.
But it's not in the operative portion of the bill.
It appears, but as a sense of Congress.
Yes.
And then appears, then no. It's further explained in the conference report.
That's not legislation.
And what about 2000?
The amendments to the travel regs in 2000.
Trade Sanctions Reform and Export Act.
That we raised that question below, but I will address it if you like this morning. But
I'm just trying to get your sense. It's your sense or your argument that Congress has not spoken?
No, Congress, I think, has clearly spoken.
Both the executive and legislative branches have indicated through their actions that they perceive a foreign policy issue of great significance. And so as I understand it, you're saying the courts really should preempt those judgments based on our sense of what? Reading the newspapers?
No. In fact, I argue that Congress has preempted executive branch authority in the specific area of travel to Cuba. The embargo authority,
this is your attempt on the Chevron, I guess. On the Chevron argument. Yeah, all right. There's obviously a different way to read all of the legislation, but you're saying your argument here is that your read of it is that the legal landscape has changed.
Yes, I think Congress has. Chevron applies in the absence of a clear indication from Congress as to how a statute's to be applied. We do have a clear indication, and it's not to be applied, Trading with the Enemy Act authority, to obstruct educational travel to Cuba, as occurred in this case.
All right. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mays.
May it please the Court, I'm Douglas Letter from the United States Department of Justice. With me today is Mr. Matthew Tushband from the Department of the Treasury. To get right to some of the questions that your honors were asking, first of all, the declaration from Professor Gonzalez, which is in the appendix at pages 121 and 122, does not say what my friend.
It goes only to causation. It doesn't go to redressability.
You're right, Your Honor. It nowhere says that Johns Hopkins will renew a program. Second, Judge Silberman, you pointed out that Mr. Muse has indicated in his reply brief the challenge to the prior regulation. I note the if you look, the First Amendment amended complaint in the appendix is quite clear that it is challenged. It uses the words is challenging the amended regulations. So that is what.
What would you concede if he was challenging both, that he would have standing?
No, because I think there would still be the redressability problem. He as Your Honor raised the question of the prudential problem, it's very striking here that there are none. The actual license applicants and holders under the regulations are the colleges and the universities, and none of them is a plaintiff here. So there is still that.
Is it your unequivocal position that, I wasn't clear from the brief, that an individual professor does not have a First Amendment right, that if there's any right at all, it's in the university?
Your Honor.
You raised a doubt about that, but you didn't flatly say it.
Your Honor, I think this is a difficult area. One, this court does not have precedent on point. What we
that doesn't stop you from making an argument in the past.
That is true, Your Honor.
Particularly with Judge Edwards on the panel.
as Your Honor knows, we pointed you to the in-bank opinion by Judge Wilkins from the Fourth Circuit in Yourofsky. And there, the Fourth Circuit, a divided court, but there the court does say that it is the right does belong to the university, not the individual. The case law is clearly mixed. I think the reason that I was raising it was to attempt to bolster.
What about the proposition that troubled me, which isn't in your brief, but of course it's legitimate on a question of standing for us to inquire? How could the individual have a constitutional right to teach what he or she wants without having that right to be a right act vis-a-vis a public university? Why didn't you make that point?
Well, I think we did, Your Honor, in the sense of we pointed out that the Supreme Court made clear in University of Pennsylvania case, which, as you know, is not a public university. But the Supreme Court did make clear there that to the extent the right exists, it goes to the content of the what the professor wants to teach. And here, as the court is aware, at no point has there been any claim whatsoever that the United States government is trying to restrict content. We don't inquire what the person is going to teach either about Cuba in the United States or what they would teach in Cuba. They could go down there and teach a course on what wonders the Castro administration has done for healthcare, something like that. We do not inquire, and therefore we're clearly not regulating content.
All right. Well, another question on standing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your argument is the plaintiff has no standing because the injury he points to is an illusion since the regulation never changed.
Correct.
Isn't that an issue of merits? And don't we always have to assume the merits of the plaintiff's claim when we're asking a standing question?
You do assume the merits, yes.
So then his merits position is this new regulation changed the legal field. We have to assume that to be correct. You can't say that's not true, therefore he has no standing, because then you're getting the merits issue in on the standing.
And as Your Honor well knows, these often do overlap quite a bit. This is
the whole key for a good Article III court is to try to make them clearly distinguish them. When they overlap, it usually causes judicial confusion.
In
fact, the Civil Division of the Justice Department has been arguing that for as long as I've been on the bench, that you have to be clear as to the distinction between the two, and you must assume the merits when you're looking at standing. Are you changing the position of the Justice Department now after all these years?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Nevertheless, we do have situations where allegations can be made that are the court can look at the face of the relevant materials and realize the allegations are inappropriate or incorrect.
Well, that's not one of these cases, because his allegation is best for your case, it's ambiguous as to whether the first regulation would have barred what the second regulation does clearly bar. So that doesn't strike me as a very particularly strong standing argument.
I'll take one more stab at it, Your Honor. I think if you look at the actual provisions, which are reprinted in the last pages of the addendum to our brief, the only provision that would possibly deal with professors does make clear that they have to be full time. So we
the
actually
old regulation, the new,
the old. The new one makes it even more clear because it moves the provision. The problem before was the provision was separated.
Well, apparently it wasn't so clear that it didn't, that everybody didn't think it meant something different, including the universities.
Which
is why you amended the regulation.
In part, obviously, to make this completely clear, Your Honor. That is true.
You doubt that Hopkins has asserted that it would intends to continue the program if the regulations were put in a form which they find acceptable?
Your Honor, I don't think we have anything in the record that says that.
The letter.
There is a letter that was written at the time, so now it's 4 years, 4+ years old. And the letter, I don't think, clearly states if this is overturned, we will reinstate. But in any event, it seems to me, if anything, that's been overtaken, that we have a declaration from a Hopkins official, and that, it's about 1.5 pages. It does not state, it doesn't even come close to stating that they would do that.
So, about the Gonzales.
Correct.
What does it say?
Goes to causation, that the government's action caused their program.
That's my recollection. Isn't that implicit? Isn't it implicit? Normally, causation and redressability, 99 and 44, 100% of the cases, it coincides. There are some unusual cases where redressability is different than causation. But typically, if someone asserts that an injury in fact had a causal connection to him or her, we assume redressability.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. But what's different here, as you know, is Hopkins is not a plaintiff. So Hopkins is not coming in. If Hopkins were the plaintiff, I think you could make that slight jump. You could
slight
say
jump. That would be overwhelming.
Yeah. Well, why would they bother suing if they weren't going to institute a program? But Hopkins.
My instinct. I've sort of been a hawk on standing for years. But my instinct is to have a separate redressability. You'd have to show something that indicate Hopkins' view is changed with respect to the causation. And I don't see that you have that.
We do not have that, Your Honor.
Why don't we go on to the merits?
I think I will do exactly as Your Honor says.
Will you unequivocally state for the government that you do not think there is any First Amendment right? Well, I don't know whether you think there's a First Amendment right in academic freedom at all, but if there is, it doesn't adhere on an individual professor?
No, Your Honor. As I've said in the brief, there is a mix of case law. What we have tried to point out is, for this case, all you would need to determine.
What is your position, though, on this issue?
As I said, for here and now, all we need to do is say, look at the Supreme Court decision, that if there is such a right in an individual, it goes to content, and that clearly is not present here. So this case can be resolved on a narrower ground than this court saying there is no such thing as individual
how could
right.
How could there be an individual right? And the hypothetical I give, where the university wishes to can a professor for teaching absurd views.
It seems to me Your Honor has raised a very good hypothetical about how could there be academic freedom in such a circumstance where the individual is being paid by the state.
But there could be an individual right in a circumstance where university and a professor were essentially in the same.
Yes, that's different. Then at the university,
so you can't make
exactly
the argument there's no individual academic freedom. I mean, they're inextricably tied at places.
That's correct. And Judge Silberman, I'm thinking, obviously, I don't want to argue against interest here, but
you seem to be doing a good job.
the one thing that I would note is, suppose you had a circumstance unlike what Your Honor has raised, a professor in a private institution, and the government, some sort of government is coming in and attempting to regulate the content of what that professor is teaching.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's an interesting hypothetical. Yeah. That would
you wouldn't
would
listen to me when I said it. I'm glad you got through.
I didn't hear you say that.
I guess neither of us was listening. But Your Honor, your hypothetical, I think, raised it in its most stark terms, where the professor's salary is being paid by the state, and I think you're absolutely right in that circumstance.
Where they're at odds, where the institution
yes.
and the individual professor are at odds.
Yes, Your Honor.
There are lots of cases where that's not the situation.
Right.
And no one has spoken clearly on it because we don't know how to unsort it as the courts.
I think, obviously, the majority of the Fourth Circuit spoke clearly, but that's not binding on this court. And as your honors are aware, there were a batch of dissents there. But again, the Supreme Court at least did speak clearly in the University of Pennsylvania case. And again, that clearly governs here. There is no attempt to regulate content. Judge Edwards, as I recall, you asked about Walsh versus Brady, and Walsh versus Brady is definitely a First Amendment case. The court there was faced with a claim that the plaintiff there was saying he had a right to engage in what he called, I think, news gathering, and this court rejected that argument on the point about fact finding. Several points to make there. Note that the Supreme Court itself in Regan versus Wald, it does cite to a declaration, but the court there says in the language in its opinion, in the opinion.
I'm thinking if you're a hypothetical. I can't. This is the fun of oral argument. In the case you provide where the state passed a law which restricted the individual speaking in a private university, so all you have is the state versus the individual. The university is not a party at all. Why wouldn't that be covered by just straight First Amendment? Why do you have to get academic freedom in there?
As Your Honor started raising that, I was thinking to myself the exact same thing. Yes. So would throwing in academic freedom make the case any better, stronger? I wouldn't think so. And as we know, when if you look back at the older opinions, Sweeney, et cetera, they do seem to be focused on either content or the university.
Academic freedom is about the First Amendment.
It is.
Academic freedom would be involved in that case.
But I take
and especially where the individual professor who is aggrieved is doing something that's not inconsistent with what the university's priorities are. And the university doesn't define for every professor precisely how you're going to teach the class. So you have a mix, and it's academic freedom that is clearly involved in that situation where the state attempts to regulate the private university and or professor.
But I take Judge Silberman's possible point as that in that circumstance, Judge Edwards, where the state is directly regulating speech, does it matter that you say it is an unconstitutional violation of his right to speak, and by the way, it's also a violation of academic freedom.
It gives meaning to the First Amendment in that context, is what we have said.
It's possible, but on the other hand, again, and I think, I believe this was from Yourofsky, Judge Wilkins pointed out, there is no case at all where the Supreme Court, at least, has struck down. More broadly, Judge Wilkins said no court has struck down some sort of state regulation involving an individual and academic freedom. So this is certainly an unexplored area. Mr. Mews
rejected it in circumstances that we've talked about.
As I say, not the Supreme Court, no, but
so it's just that's to say nothing.
Fourth Circuit.
It's an issue that hasn't been addressed.
And certainly not by this court. And fortunately, as I said, you don't have to get.
Some respect for our brother circuit, sister circuit, the Fourth Circuit. It's true.
I believe you have lots of respect for Judge Wilkins and the judges who voted with him there.
I even have respect for those who dissented.
That's.
Before you finish up, I just want to hear you address the so-called Chevron argument, that is, that the statutory regime now, outside of this First Amendment argument that we've been talking about, the APA claim that the government can't get where they are in promulgating a regulation of this sort.
Your Honor, the argument is a straightforward one. I'm sorry, let me back up. The President has been granted authority by Congress in TWIA, and so that is the font of his, at least statutory authority. As this Court is well aware, we also argue in these types of circumstances he has independent Article II authority. There is no statute that undermines the power that has been granted to the President in TWIA. The two statutes were raised below, the District Court Judge Uvell ruled against him, and Mr. Muse has not pursued those before this Court, which is quite wise, because the trade statute, the 2001, it goes directly to tourist activities, but it makes clear that it's not talking about educational activities, and so it doesn't apply. So that can't be used to undermine the President's power based on his interpretation of his power based on TWIA. And the other statute, the Fair Ideas statute, is just a sense of Congress. So what we have is an assignment of power to the President in the foreign affairs realm, where both this Court and the Supreme Court has emphasized the President has the broadest possible
what
delegation.
What do you do with the language in Justice Rehnquist's opinion which suggests that counsel put it in terms of as a finding that there was extraordinary important national interest at stake in the embargo?
Your Honor, I think that what we have to look at is Justice Rehnquist's opinion, and at page, let's see, it would be 243, so 468 U.S. 243, where Justice Rehnquist said, in the opinion of the State Department, Cuba with the political, economic, military backing, Soviet Union, et cetera, and then that's followed with, given the traditional deference to executive judgment in this vast external realm, we think there's an adequate basis. So I think—
An adequate basis. Does that mean that the Court does make a judgment as to whether the foreign policy concerns are weighty enough? He did say that in his language, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. And so we don't argue that in a constitutional case the Court has no role. However, cases such as Regan, cases such as Dames and Moore make clear, and Walsh versus Brady make clear, that the courts have traditionally followed a limited role. And I can't think, actually, of any instance when either this Court or the Supreme Court has overturned a significant foreign policy judgment like this made by the executive and said, you know what, we disagree. This Court, for instance, in the Holy Land Foundation case is another instance where you properly deferred to the judgments made by the executive branch. Just to follow up on that one more step, I know some members of the Court have significant foreign policy experience, but how would you go about making these judgments? Would you have testimony? Would you bring in the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the President, you know, himself? And would the district court have that person get on the stand and explain why they thought, what the CIA had told them, what the Director of National Intelligence was saying? Would there be cross-examination? I think this Court and the Supreme Court are well aware that just wouldn't and couldn't work within the separation of powers. So the courts have properly deferred.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Muse, you had no time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll need less than that. I only want to address the implication that I may have mischaracterized Professor Gonzalez's declaration. In the joint appendix, if you read together Professor Smith's declaration at page 119, paragraph 9, he says, we would have continued those Johns Hopkins programs that were discontinued as a result of the regulatory action challenged in this case. Professor Gonzalez, at page 122, paragraph 6, talks about the restrictions causing the termination of the programs. His final sentence reads, as a result, just as study abroad programs on campus, Johns Hopkins campus, experienced a boom, the doors of access of similar programs in Cuba have remained shut. I think it's a fair implication that if the regulations were rescinded, the doors would reopen, and Professor Gonzalez, in his role as head of the Latin America Department, is saying that they would reinstitute the programs. Thank you.